Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 41. I'm going to cover verses 1 through 36, the first part of chapter 41, in which we see Joseph interpreting Pharaoh's dreams, predicting the coming famine. Our context is this: in the last part, in fact, the whole of the preceding chapter, Genesis 40, we see Joseph interpreting his two fellow prisoners' dreams, the Pharaoh's former cupbearer and baker. We need to distinguish the dreams. Chapter 40 is the dreams while he was in prison, and chapter 41 are the dreams when he's out of prison. Chapter 40 was the dreams that he had with the Pharaoh's two officials, the cupbearer and the baker. Chapter 41 is the dreams that the Pharaoh had. So we start now in Genesis 41, 1 through 4. Now it happened at the end of two full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he was standing by the Nile. And lo, from the Nile there came up seven cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed in the marsh grass. Then behold, seven other cows came up after them from the Nile, ugly and gaunt, and they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. The ugly and gaunt cows ate up the seven sleek and fat cows. Then Pharaoh awoke. Two full years later, it was at the end of two full years that Pharaoh had a dream. When did the two-year period start? It could have been from the time that Joseph was put in prison, as most likely from the time that the chief butler was taken out. The chief butler, of course, being the cupbearer. He was supposed to tell the Pharaoh, hey, this guy in prison interpreted my dream. How about getting him out? But he didn't do it. So we're going to assume it's been 2 years since the cupbearer got out. And during those 2 years, he said nothing about Joseph's ability to interpret the dream, despite the fact that Joseph had begged him, said, please show a kindness to me and tell the Pharaoh, put in a good word for the Pharaoh. Cupbearer didn't do it. Now, these cows came out of the Nile River, the famous Nile River, which was notoriously famous for the prosperity of Egypt or the lack of prosperity of Egypt. If the Nile flooded, the waters went all to the sides, watering the land, and there was prosperity. But if the Nile did not flood, as it went from south to north, from Upper Egypt to Lower Egypt, if it did not flood, then there was famine. There wasn't a good crop. Now, in the dream, the cows came up out of the Nile. You might think, well, that's sort of strange for cows to come up out of the Nile River, but it's a dream, so what difference does it make? Dreams are weird. No, but actually, in real life, cattle often submerge themselves up to their necks in the Nile to escape the sun and to escape insects, so that was a natural thing in the dream. Notice that the gaunt cows, when they came out, they didn't eat any marsh grass. The fat cows grazed in the marsh grass. Well, that's a good symbol. Fat cow grazing the grass, there's plenty to eat, plenty of prosperity, but the gaunt cows just came up and stood. They represented famine, and they weren't eaten, because you don't eat in a famine. We go now to Genesis 41, verses 5 through 7. He, that's the Pharaoh, fell asleep and dreamed a second time. And by the way, we don't know who this Pharaoh is. There's been a lot of speculation as to which Pharaoh Joseph was dealing with. I don't know. Very interesting speculation, but it's the stuff you watch on YouTube videos and read speculative articles about. But whichever Pharaoh it was, he fell asleep and dreamed a second time. And behold, seven ears of grain came up on a single stalk, plump and good. Then behold, seven ears, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. The thin ears swallowed up the seven plump and full ears. Then Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Now there, of course, you have an incident in the dream that doesn't happen in real life, where you have thin ears swallowing up full ears. I can sort of imagine that in my head as if it were in a dream. And another unnatural detail of the dream is seven ears of grain on one stalk. That's an awful lot. And then, of course, you had seven more ears, 14 ears on a grain of stalk. That's much more than you normally see on a stalk of grain. Now, the thin ears, which grew out, sprouted, were scorched by the east wind. Now, that east wind is a particular east wind. If you'll think about the geography of Egypt, to the east of Egypt, there's nothing but desert. You go, first of all, through the desert of Shur, or even further south, you got the Sinai Desert. Then you go through the desert of Shur. Then if you keep going past Eilat, the tip of the Suez Gulf, and then at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, you keep going east. And then there's that big desert, the Arabian Desert, there between the Jordan River or the Gulf of Araba and the Mesopotamian Valley. Is nothing but desert. So if wind comes from the east to Egypt, It's going to be hot and dry. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about that east wind. Quote, the Palestinian Sirocco in Egypt, it's called the Khamsin, which blows in from the desert in late spring and early fall, often withers vegetation. Adam Clark says, all the mischief done to corn or fruit by blasting, smutting, mildews, locusts, etc. is attributed to the east wind. In the scriptures, I'm going to read some scriptures in a minute that shows that. Adam Clark says that this east wind often destroys vast number of men and women. So you see, just mentioning the east wind to our Western ears, we read that and don't think too much of it, but it had special meaning for people who were reading Genesis and were familiar with the culture and the geography. Here's some other examples in scriptures of the east wind. Hosea 13:15, although he, referring to Israel, flourishes among his brothers, an east wind will come, a wind from the Lord rising up from the desert. His water source will fail, and his spring will run dry. The wind will plunder the treasury of every precious item. So there you see the east wind as a symbol of total destruction of Israel. Ezekiel 17:10, even though it, referring to Israel, is planted, will it flourish? Won't it wither completely when the east wind strikes it? It will wither on the plot where it is sprouted. So the east wind will wipe out Israel. Exodus 10:13. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt. This is when the 10 plagues were hitting Egypt. And the Lord sent an east wind over the land all that day and through the night. By morning, the east wind had brought in the locusts. So the east wind brought in destruction, locusts that ate up the land in one of the 10 plagues. Jonah 4:8. As the sun was rising, this was near Nineveh, God appointed a scorching east wind. Nineveh, of course, is in the northern Tigris River near present-day Mosul. God appointed a scorching east wind. The sun beat down on Jonah's head so much that he almost fainted and he wanted to die. He said, it is better for me to die than to live. I recall I was at a place in China, in the west of China near Tulifan, which is one of the hottest places in China. And there was a place, it's kind of a tourist place, and a lot of Chinese people don't really know about it. I think it was called Xiaohe, Little River, or something like that. But it was where two canyons, if you will, intersected. They were the beds of ancient rivers that had dried up. So you get up on the landmass that was between those two canyons, and there was a little ancient village there that was built in the caves to get out of the heat. And I remember walking through that wind, and it was blowing in your face real hard, and it was over 120 degrees Fahrenheit, and my head started spinning. I said, I think this wind's going to kill me. I mean, it's unbearable. It's beyond belief. I actually went down in one of those caves just to cool off to get my thoughts together. So this east wind is going to do a number on Egypt. We go now to verse 8, Genesis 41. Now in the morning, his spirit, that's the Pharaoh's spirit, was troubled after his two dreams. So he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Now, who were these magicians? Well, perhaps they were those who had, or at least claimed to have, occult powers, demonic powers, if you will. But the word magician may also mean something like a wise man. And a wise man would be someone who is an interpreter of abstruse and difficult subjects, as Adam Clark says, especially hieroglyphics. So in other words, it could be a combination of intellect and demonism here that these magicians were appealing to. Here's what Adam Clark says about the phrase wise men. See, magicians and wise men could refer to the same group of people, or it could refer to two separate groups of people. It's not really clear here in the text. Here's what Clark says about wise men. Quote, they addicted themselves to the worship of God and the study of wisdom, passing their whole life in the contemplation of divine things, contemplation of the stars, self-purification, arithmetic, and geometry, sounds like Pythagoreans, and singing hymns in honor of their gods was their continual employment. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about these wise men. Quote, it is not possible to define the exact distinction between magicians and wise men, but they formed different branches of a numerous body who laid claim to supernatural skill in occult arts and sciences, in revealing mysteries, explaining portents, and above all, interpreting dreams. Long practice had rendered them expert in devising a plausible way of getting out of every difficulty and framing an answer suitable to the occasion. So not only were they intellectual, and not only did they exercise black magic, but they were slick with their tongue. Sounds like members of a certain political party, I know. There was no one who could interpret the dreams, despite all of these professional magicians and wise men. Was it because they could not interpret the dreams? I mean, after all, you look at the dreams, it's not that hard to interpret, in my opinion. It might be because I have the benefit of hindsight, and I've read the Genesis account enough to know what the dreams meant. Maybe if I was confronted with the dreams point blank, with no background, I might not have been able to interpret it, but I don't know. It seems like it's fairly easy to interpret. So it might be that these magicians and wise men saw what the dreams meant, but they didn't want to tell the Pharaoh the bad news. After all, what are kings famous for? Killing the messenger. But at any rate, they didn't interpret the dreams, and the fact that no one could or no one did interpret the dreams, that made Joseph's feat in interpreting the dreams even greater by contrast. We go now to Genesis 41, verses 9 through 13. Then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Pharaoh was furious with his servant, and he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. Captain of the bodyguard is Potiphar, the famous Potiphar whose wife tried to seduce Joseph. Verse 11, Genesis 41, we had a dream on the same night. That's the cupbearer and the baker had a dream on the same night. He and I, each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now a Hebrew youth was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard, that's Potiphar's servant, and we related them to him, related the dreams to Joseph, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream. In other words, the cupbearer had a dream, and the baker had a dream, and Joseph interpreted both of them separately because they had different interpretations. Because the cupbearer's interpretation was, you're going to be sprung in 3 days, and the baker's interpretation was, you're going to be executed in 3 days. Verse 13, and just as he, Joseph, interpreted for us, the cupbearer and the baker, so it happened. He restored me in my office. Joseph restored me in my office, but he, Joseph, hanged him. And what that means is Joseph, by interpreting the dream in such a way, is said to have restored the cupbearer to his office, although, of course, it was Pharaoh who did that. And when he says he hanged him, he's saying Joseph hanged him by interpreting the dream in such a way that the baker was hanged, but, of course, actually, the Pharaoh did the hanging. Now, the chief cupbearer came to Pharaoh saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Well, he was supposed to mention Joseph a couple of years ago, and he didn't do it. He was obviously trying to ingratiate himself with the Pharaoh now, so no credit should be given to him for mentioning Joseph now. He was a selfish person. I would make mention today of my own offenses. What offenses? Well, it could be the offense of forgetting to mention Joseph after the cupbearer released him from prison. That's John Gill's idea, suggestion. But Adam Clark says, well, it's impossible to think the cupbearer would actually forget what had happened in prison. He found it convenient to forget, as Adam Clark says. He didn't want to use up all his credit with Pharaoh on a jailbird, so he just didn't mention Joseph because Joseph was a nobody in jail. But now he's thinking, maybe I can get some credit if I can introduce the Pharaoh to a man who can interpret this dream. Pharaoh's obviously upset. He can't get any of his wise men or magicians to do it. If I can produce somebody who can interpret this dream, maybe I'll get some credit. Well, I don't think the cupbearer saying to Pharaoh, I would make mention today of my own offenses and forgetting to tell you about Joseph. He's talking about, I would make mention today of my own offenses that got him thrown into jail 2 years earlier or several years earlier. Pharaoh had either pardoned the cupbearer or found him innocent. I imagine it's the latter. Somebody tries to poison the Pharaoh. I can't imagine him getting pardoned. And the cupbearer probably didn't want to bring this up. Sort of unpleasant. An unpleasant memory to bring it up, but he was thinking about, well, maybe I'll get some credit for this. Now, in verse 10, the cupbearer says, Pharaoh was furious with his servants. Now, that Pharaoh is not a proper name. He would never use a proper name of the Pharaoh. It's a title of an office. The cupbearer says to the Pharaoh, there was a Hebrew youth in jail with him there. Joseph was about 28 when he was in prison. How do we know that? Well, Joseph was 30 years old when he went to the Pharaoh to interpret his dream. We read that in Genesis 41:46. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And we know from verse 1 in chapter 41 here that it had been 2 years since the cupbearer had been released, so that makes Joseph about 28 while he was in jail. We go now to Genesis 41:14. Then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon, and when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came to Pharaoh. Now, Egyptians were usually smooth-shaven, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Palestinians wore beards, as the NIV Study Bible says. The Egyptians were the only nation, really, in the ancient Near East that liked to be smooth-shaven, so all slaves and foreigners upon arrival in Egypt had to shave. Now, perhaps Joseph had reverted to his old customs while he was in jail and grew a beard, or maybe he just neglected shaving because he was in prison. And John Gill says that usually happens with prisoners. I don't think Joseph would have done that. He probably was growing a beard because that's what he liked to do, because that's what Jews like to do. The word shaved could mean trimmed, but when he had trimmed himself and changed his clothes, Adam Clark says that this is the case because it is unlikely that Egyptians or Hebrews shaved in our sense of the word. But whatever, he changed his clothes, he dolled himself up because he's going to see the Pharaoh. We go down to verses 15 and 16 in Genesis 41. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I have heard it said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph then answered Pharaoh, saying, It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Pharaoh said he had heard about Joseph. Where had he heard about Joseph? Well, probably the cupbearer, because we just read about that. It could be other people that heard about Joseph's skill. We don't know, but at any rate, Joseph is given credit for being able to interpret dreams, and Pharaoh acknowledges that. But Joseph immediately says, Well, wait a minute now, Pharaoh. It's not me that does this. This is God that does it. Very modest, he defers to God. We turn now to Genesis 41, verses 17 through 21. So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, In my dream, behold, I was standing on the bank of the Nile, and behold, seven cows, fat and sleek, came up out of the Nile, and they grazed in the marsh grass. Lo, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such as I had never seen for ugliness in all the land of Egypt. And the lean and ugly cows ate up the first seven fat cows. Yet when they had devoured them, it could not be detected that they had devoured them, for they were just as ugly as before. Then I awoke. Now, of course, this dream is connected with the Nile. If the Nile floods, overflows a lot, then you got a lot of prosperity. If it doesn't, then you have a lot of famine. And we got seven cows, fat and sleek. They grazed in the marsh grass. And in verse 19, the Pharaoh says he's never seen cows as ugly and skinny as the cows that came out of the Nile that ate up the fat cows. And when they ate up the fat cows, the skinny cows remained just as skinny as they were before they ate, which, of course, shows the strength of the famine. We go now to Genesis 41, verses 22 through 24. Pharaoh continues, I saw also in my dream, and behold, seven ears, full and good, came up on a single stalk. And lo, seven ears, withered, thin, and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. And the thin ears swallowed the seven good ears. Then I told it to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me. This is a repeat of the dream. We've already gone over this. He did shorten it a little bit, the Pharaoh did, because he makes it sound like the dream of the seven cows and the dream of the seven ears happened in the same dream, but actually woke up in between, as we saw back in verses 4 and 5. We go now to Genesis 41, verses 25 through 27. Now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one and the same. The seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven thin ears scorched by the east wind will be 7 years of famine. Now, why did Pharaoh have two dreams with the exact same interpretation? James and Fawcett and Brown say it was just for emphasis, so that God would let Pharaoh know, Boy, you are in a heap of trouble. There's going to be 7 years of famine, and I told you that not just once, but twice. Now, 7 years of famine is pretty much of a calamity for the Pharaoh, because long famines are rare in Egypt because of the regularity of the Nile, so it was unusual to have 7 years of famine. Genesis 41, verses 28 through 32, we continue. Joseph continues, It is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt, and after them 7 years of famine will come. And all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. So the abundance will be unknown in the land because of that subsequent famine, for it will be very severe. Now, as for the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, it means that the matter is determined by God, and God will quickly bring it about. Joseph explains why Pharaoh had two dreams that had the same interpretation. It means it's definitely coming, and it's fast coming. Repeating a divine revelation under different figures is often done for emphasis in Old Testament prophecy. Now we go to Genesis 41, verses 33 through 36. Now let Pharaoh, this is Joseph continuing to speak, now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. Then let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority, and let them guard it. Let the food become as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which will occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land will not perish during the famine. Now when Joseph suggests that Pharaoh look for a man to oversee the distribution of the grain, he was of course not thinking of himself. As John Gill says, Joseph was too modest to be thinking of himself. However, he did open himself up to a charge that he was self-interested, because it looked like he was suggesting that Pharaoh appoint him. This is my idea. Joseph, because of the prestige he had gotten by interpreting the dream, would naturally be considered by Pharaoh to be a candidate, a top candidate for the job, you would think. And so Joseph makes it look like he's pushing himself here. He doesn't mean to, I'm sure. Adam Clark says it is impossible that Joseph could have foreseen his own elevation. And I say to Mr. Clark, well, why not? Because he had just gotten out of prison? Because being in charge of a whole country is too big a leap to contemplate? Well, maybe Joseph might have thought that might have been a big jump for him. So maybe he wasn't foreseeing the big promotion that was coming. We don't know. But at any rate, I do think we can assume that Joseph was not self-seeking here. He was genuinely worried about how to manage the famine in Egypt. Now, Joseph suggests in verse 34 that Pharaoh exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. That's 20% of all the grain would be taken by the state, by Pharaoh, and stored. Now, here's some options as to how that might have been done. Three options. Option number one, the grain could have been bought on the open market. In the time of plenty, it would be pretty cheap because there'd be so much of it, an oversupply, and Pharaoh could have bought it with any financial reserves he might have had and stored it. That would have been the most just way to do it. Another way he could have done it is through the use of what we call eminent domain. He could say, this is an emergency, take the grain, but then with eminent domain, the state compensates the owners with a just price. So it wouldn't really be a purchase on the open market. It would be a taking, but then the owner of the grain would be compensated for it. That would be a little less just, but it would be just. Or, the third option, Pharaoh could have just taken the grain, like a tax. John Gill says a wise and just man like Joseph would never advise that, and I tend to agree with that, because that's just stealing somebody's grain. I remember one time when I was at seminary, and there were these so-called Christian socialist sojourners, they call themselves, Jim Wallace and crowd, who mentioned this as an example of how the state can help out in times of trouble. I said, yeah. Sure, the state can do that, make you a slave. And of course, Jim Wallace and his socialism, that's exactly what he would have, is that citizens would be the slave of the state in order for the good of the people. That's what socialists always say as they implement their slavery, their economic slavery. I hope that what Pharaoh did was bought this grain on the open market. He just didn't steal it like socialists like to do. Why did Joseph ask for a fifth of the grain, 20% each year? Why not 50% each year? 50% each year, then you could, during the famine years, you could lay that grain over for the famine years and that take care of it. Well, that was not necessary. Why? Well, as John Gill points out, people would be laying up private stocks of grain as well as the Pharaoh's government. So those private stocks would be available during the famine. And also people would consume less than they normally did in the 7 years of famine. And so you wouldn't need to take half of the crop during the seven good years, just 20% will do. 20% is still pretty steep. But in the time of enormous plenty, the people could bear that. So 20% tax, basically. The next thing that Joseph advised the Pharaoh to do is to store up the grain in cities under the Pharaoh's authority. In other words, distribute the grain all over the empire, all over the Egyptian empire, to better take care of the famine. So Joseph, once again, knows how to manage. He managed Potiphar's house, he managed the prison, and now he's managing all of Egypt. He's going to as soon as the Pharaoh appoints him. And with that, we have finished verses 1 through 36 in Genesis 41, which prepares us to move ahead in our next audio to Genesis 41, verses 37 through 57, the end of the chapter, and we will see Joseph rise to power in Egypt. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.